Welcome, dumbheads, to this week's Megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one micro-podcast per day identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Ninjas and Super Spies, the ridiculous RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the previous week's episodes in one Megasode, like this one. If you want to follow along at home, we are reading Revised Ninjas and Super Spies, 7th printing, from the year 2000. Today we're discussing page 139 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and this page does begin the chase rules, which are a terrible, terrible idea I can't not talk about. They take what was a fairly elegant, albeit non-functional, mechanically fucked vehicle combat system, and they single-handedly super fuck it by introducing this whole new set of maneuvers that are pretty much redundant, and they add another phase to vehicle combat. It's a real mess. Like, there was already a maneuver for pursuing foes, but now I have to roll to pursue my foe before I can pursue my foe. This whole half-ass idea inherently breaks the good rule about taking only one vehicle action per turn, but it doesn't explain how that relates to the melee round system. Basically, the only material of value here is some maneuvers that involve other traffic, like getting away from your foe by rushing through a gap in traffic and hoping they can't follow. But that would work a lot better as a vehicle combat maneuver than a whole, like, separate phase. Like, let's set up a sideboard for vehicle pursuit. It's such a bad idea that I can't not talk about it, but it isn't what I want to talk about today. Because this page, as we talked about last time, contains the last part of the Ballad of Mike and Fran, an extended example of combat that provides a rare opportunity in the context of Mega Dumbcast to talk about actual play practices, rather than just rules. So I'm going to preach for 5 minutes here. If that's not your thing, I totally understand, and I will see you next time. The title of our sermon today is Why Isn't Franny Shooting? Now, the point of the vehicle combat example that we read last time was to teach us the vehicle combat rules, and Mike was the one driving. So while the example managed to get basically everything wrong when it comes down to the actual numbers and details, in terms of focus, it did give us a tour of all the important aspects of vehicle combat, but it also gave us some extraneous material, like the sports car firing on Mike and Fran's caddy, right? We didn't need that to understand vehicle combat. What it didn't give us was any meaningful action being taken by Fran. Now, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that this snippet of play may have been based on an actual play experience, because it's a very clear example of something that often happens to players, and especially female players, where the GM consciously or unconsciously directs the action toward certain favored members of the player group and really only hears the other players when they take actions that feed into the star player's ideas. It can be easy to miss this happening at your table, especially when you're engrossed in the main thread of the action. But take a look at this play example, and let's just look at Fran's actions and trim the other stuff out. When the Cadillac is coming up on some broken road, Fran advises not going too fast. When the truck pulls out in front of the caddy, Fran advises Mike not to stop, because it might be an ambush. After the attempted cutoff, Fran asks if there are other vehicles out there in the woods. The GM answers, addressing his response to the group, and Mike is the one to react. When Mike asks about other cars behind them, Fran interjects and has her character look out the back of the car so Mike won't have to take his eyes off the road. When Mike asks about road conditions and the GM won't tell, because he's an impish old-school GM, Fran spends her action to get out a map and get that information for Mike. Once the chase with the sports car starts, Fran puts her gun out the back gun port when it's behind them, then the side port when the sports car is beside them, then the front gun port when the sports car is in front of them, trying to get a beat on it as Mike's maneuvering keeps changing its position. Then the example ends with Fran saying she might be able to finally fire her pistol, and Mike telling her she's not going to do that. She's going to shoot the machine gun instead. Please notice that Mike is like executive player character supremo in this scenario, and Fran is an assistant player character. Like, she is an adjunct PC. Most of what Fran does is just asking for information, or in some cases spending actions to get information that Mike wants. It's always Mike who decides and acts. And toward the end, when Fran does draw her own weapon, notice that she never gets to fire. We talked last time about how this example gets the action order and the economy all screwed up, and that's very common in actual play, because we're following the thread of the action when we're actually playing a game at the table. If the story is Super Spy Shoots Ninja, the next thing we want to know is whether Ninja dodges, right? So the action economy be damned, the next thing we'll probably resolve is the Ninja's dodge roll. When the story is Spy and Ninja and Fran, oftentimes Fran gets excluded because she's not part of the main action. Her turns get missed, we presume she's doing something irrelevant to the action, or we jump to her when her actions are needed to drive the story of interest happening between other characters. We see this happen in the example when we jump to her to have her check the map, when Mike needs her to. We don't jump from Fran putting her gun in the gun port to Mike trying to line up a shot for her. This is why Fran spends her actions in the last half of this example scrambling from gunport to gunport, trying to participate as the narrative is passing her by. What's happening is analogous to what frequently happens in classrooms, as has often been discussed. It seems perfectly normal in the moment when the thread of conversation just happens to naturally lead to certain male students dominating the discussion, but there's nothing natural about it. The relevant GMs or teachers in these situations may or may not overtly favor the male students or feel dismissive toward the female ones, but it doesn't even matter. The broader gender dynamics of the situation, like aside from the class or the game, just the interaction of human beings in the room together in a mixed gender environment leads to an environment where males take the lead and females try to keep up, which will inevitably lead to the perception that women can't keep up. Because when you're in the driver's seat, you always get to take an action, right? But when you're Fran, you only get to take an action if you can guess where Mike is going and get to the right gun port. And if you don't, if you guess wrong, then Mike keeps making moves while you play catch-up or end up getting skipped altogether. Quickly, the lesson that Fran learns at the gaming table or in other conversation-driven situations like classrooms is that you tend to get the most spotlight time and get your questions answered by tagging along on Mike's train of thought rather than pursuing your own. Notice that Fran's much more part of the action early on in the scene when she's getting info for Mike, advising him on his decisions, than in the later half where Fran's trying to shoot Fran's gun at Fran's enemies and she keeps getting thwarted, Glock-blocked, if you will, by the fact that Mike's thing always takes precedence. One of the advantages of this very short podcast format is that I do not feel obligated to offer answers to the problems that I raise. So I don't propose to solve systemic sexism in 5 minutes or whatever this turns out to be. But I did want to spotlight this problem in actual play practices as the dumbest thing on this page. This is an example. Its function is literally, you should play like this. And that's a real problem because while bad rules can be overcome in gaming, bad social play practices cannot. In this scenario, Fran can and should ask the GM to cut this shit out, and for that matter, so should Mike. But if the GM won't, no amount of clever rules hacking or deep storytelling is going to make role-playing fun for Fran. And that's a real problem because we need Fran. So there's your one-day respite from talking about dumb rules. Hopefully you enjoyed it, because tomorrow we're on to Dumb Vehicle Rules of Sea and Sky on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 140 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and today we're going to talk about some non-ground vehicles. We're going to talk about boats, and we're going to talk about aircraft. And, you know, rockets too, but these rules don't really get into the details of space combat. Presumably this is Star Wars rules where flying in space is just like flying in an atmosphere, only anything that would normally go pa 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 instead goes doo doo doo. Otherwise, basically the same thing. So aquatic and air combat, and do we ever have like a tale of two dumb rule systems here? It is very hard for me to choose as the arbiter of dumbness for Ninjas and Super Spies which of these is worse. So let me just talk it out and we'll come to a conclusion together. Let's start with boat combat. The whole boat combat rules section is like one half of this one page. Because as we established back in the vehicle construction section, the author could not possibly give one shit less about boats. And you could totally hear it in the introduction to this section too, which is bordering on passive aggressive. Basically, these rules start with a complaint about how hard they were to write. You can hear it in the tone. I quote, "Just as land vehicles can go out of control, so can boats and ships. The big problem with watercraft is that they have no effective braking system. A ship heading in the wrong way can't do much more than kick in the drive system and try to veer or back up. And if wind and or waves start a ship rolling on its side, there's not a whole lot of ways to keep it steady." And then it just goes straight to the rules. Like, if you're piloting a boat, it sucks. There's not much you can do. Here are rules. What follows is a list of things that might cause you to have to make a control roll, such as swerving to avoid a collision, docking with another ship, going fast, backing up, rough water for weather reasons, rough water for non-weather reasons, and swerving again. That's the complete list of everything that can happen on a boat. I'm sorry. That's all there is to piloting a ship or a boat. There are no boat combat maneuvers. There are no boat pursuit rules, which in a game based at least partly on the James Bond franchise is a grievous oversight because it's just not a real James Bond movie unless it has like two interminable boat chases that you completely forgot about since the last time you watched it. But here we are with pretty much no rules for boat chases. And if we did have a boat chase, we wouldn't be good at it, because while there is an offensive driving skill, as we talked about, that amps up your ground vehicle piloting skills so that you can do tricky maneuvers and engage in automobile combat, and there is an air-to-air combat skill that does the same thing for aircraft, theoretically, one of these things is not like the other. There is no aquatic version of this skill. There is no boat-to-boat battle. There is no sail hard with a vengeance. If you are a badass combat mariner, go ahead and spend that extra skill selection on swimming, because what you're not going to get really good at is staying afloat in boat combat. In fact, there just aren't a lot of skills overall to deal with aquatic combat. There are three pilot skills that could relate to aquatic vehicles: pilot boat motor, pilot boat sail, and pilot submarine. These are relatively hard skills. Motorboats and sailboats start at 64%, plus 4% per level. Submarine starts at 54%, plus 4% per level. There aren't a lot of ways to get these skills, and if you can, the bonuses are not great. But just for the sake of illustration, let's assume that you are an optimized submarine pilot. You are a private investigator, obviously the game's premier submarine pilot, and you have taken one of two career paths to get a plus 5% skill program bonus to this skill. Either you cashed in that golden ticket to a World of Wonder military helicopter aviation school, and you learned how to pilot a sub in helicopter school, so you're basically a military submarine captain, or you got this skill from the basic journalism skill program, which offers one basic pilot skill. So, you know, you were a reporter, you got a job at a big metropolitan newspaper in a coastal city, nobody liked you, you got the deep ocean beat, and before you know it, you've learned how to pilot a submarine. Either way, the result's the same. You end up with a plus 15% for being a PI, a plus 5% for your skill program. That's a 20% added to the 54%. You've got a 74% base skill with submarine piloting. Because there is no poop deck puissance skill or whatever, that's all you get for your submarine-related tasks. Now, you may or may not know that throughout the 20th century, it was most common for submarines to be resupplied by tender ships, right? Other little ships that come up and connect with them to resupply them at sea. Not done as much anymore, but it used to be the way submarines operated in the 20th century when this game was written, and where this game has stayed since it is frozen in the technology and geopolitics of the late 1980s. So if you're a submarine captain, or, you know, lead reporter on News Sub 6, part of your routine duties is to dock with other ships. That is a minus 15% penalty, which means that, presuming the military career path, after you completed your military training, completed your military service, were discharged, and started your PI agency, you somehow managed to get through that whole thing with only a 59% chance of successfully resupplying a sub. Now, what happens, you ask, if you fail? Well, naturally, you roll on one of the best named tables in this book, the Aquatic Loss of Control table. Sadly, this is not a table you roll on if you are a gill man and being spurned by a human woman makes you want to go beat up a passing shark. It is instead a table telling you what kind of damage your ship takes if you fail one of these control rolls. To quickly hit the highlights, there's a 5% chance that you roll your ship over and make it inoperable, a 5% chance that it sinks outright, a 20% chance of a collision. A collision in a sub is likely to do catastrophic damage. So if you're rolling on this table, you've got a cumulative 30% chance of a pretty disastrous consequence, plus another 15% chance of swamping your sub. It's not going to sink right away, but you've pretty much managed to fill it up with water, so it's going to need to be pumped. If you're being resupplied at sea, this is maybe not the sort of thing you have the time, manpower, or facilities for. So if you've got an important submarine mission, if you're not just out fucking around in a submarine, don't send a first-level submarine captain slash aquatic editor-in-chief, because this poor bastard's only got a 59% chance of even doing routine upkeep on the sub, let alone piloting it in combat. But even for a higher-level sub-pilot, the math is not favorable. Consider a sixth-level sub-pilot, a seasoned professional, a true military man, or a damn fine reporter. The Palladium system has really given this guy the shaft, because while a sixth-level ground pilot is, I remind you, able to effortlessly drift in his motorcycle going 400 miles per hour in a ball pit, a submarine pilot of the same level can successfully pull off a routine resupply almost 4 out of 5 times, which when you consider the consequences on the aquatic loss of control table, means that he has the hard-fought distinction of totaling the sub only about 10% of the time that he tries to bring more rations and crew on board. Keep in mind that even this distinction is available only to the PI, that Master of Aquatic Combat. Any other character, such as, for example, the Academy Officer character, the seasoned military man who may well have been a naval commander, will have an even worse chance of not colliding with his tender ships. This is all a mechanical artifact, of course, of the fact that the author didn't give a shit about boats and didn't want to write about them. You know what the author did want to write about? Air combat. Dogfighting. In fact, in stark contrast to the punishing boat combat rules, dogfighting is open to everyone. Almost all air combat maneuvers require you to roll your speed class, plus a d20, plus your vehicle's transient maneuvering factor, a measure of maneuverability that this game occasionally references but forgot to include. So none of these rolls are technically workable, but assuming you're in comparable craft, presumably they would equal out anyway. Just roll a d20 plus speed class. What you don't need to roll is your pilot aircraft skill, because in the author's enthusiasm to get everybody into a cockpit blasting away at each other, he forgot to make the fighter jet skill a prerequisite for fighting in a jet. There is an air-to-air combat skill, by the way, but you don't need it, because establishing a dogtail, getting out of a dogtail, jinking, rolling, gunnery, pretty much every aspect of air combat has nothing to do with either air-to-air combat or your aircraft pilot skill. Ironically, because these aircraft skills are advanced pilot skills, they're actually easier to get at high percentages than any of the boat skills. So you can be a much better fighter jet pilot on paper than you are a submarine pilot, but it's irrelevant, because while you need a naval commission, a PI's license, and a fucking press credential to dock 2 sailboats in open water, all you need is the ability to start up a fighter jet or have someone start it up for you in order to participate fully in the joy of aerial combat. I'm going to split the difference and say that this extreme asymmetry between aquatic combat and aerial combat is the dumbest thing on this page. If you are a proud graduate of military helicopter aviation school, you may well have learned submarine piloting, helicopter combat, and race car driving from the same program and the very same school. But if you have, you'll find that you are inexplicably an infallible driver, a dangerously incompetent subpilot, and share the same basic competence in supersonic aerial combat that is apparently the birthright of every human being. Today we're discussing page 141 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and it's time to party because today is Bizarro Day! This is one of those days and one of those pages when everything is exactly the opposite of what it should be. I know this is just paranoia. This is podcast madness striking me from doing a daily podcast for so long now. But it's one of those days when it begins to feel deliberate. Like, how could you get everything, not just wrong, but exactly opposite of what it should be so consistently on a single page of this book? And I don't know how it happened, but I do know that what it affects and what it affects pervasively is air combat. If you play a character or try to play a character who engages in a lot of aerial combat, you're going to immediately bump into this rampant illogic. It does not require a close read to see the problems. Let's start with something we discussed a little last time, which is TMF, Transient Maneuvering Factor. This all-important stat is added to virtually everything you try to do in aerial combat. All of your dogfighting of various kinds, gaining a dogtail, losing a dogtail, jinking, doing rollovers, all of it requires you to add the TMF, the transient maneuvering factor of your vehicle, which, as we discussed last time, does not exist. It is a feature vehicles are supposed to have, but don't in this game. So you can't really do all these things you're meant to do. The mechanics don't work. The importance of the TMF is so great that even what is called a speed escape, which is simply an attempt to say, fuck it, I don't want to deal with aerial combat, I'm going to fly in a straight line away as fast as I can. Even that is not just pure speed class. Even that requires you to add the transient maneuvering factor of your vehicle to your roll. But not every combat action does. There are exactly 2 things you can attempt in aerial combat that do not require you to roll, and therefore know, your TMF. The first of them is the maneuver escape. Yes, the attempt to escape aerial combat by taking advantage of your maneuverability and making quick changes in course and speed does not factor in your vehicle's maneuverability. Again, even flying in a straight line requires you to roll your vehicle's maneuverability, but not specifically using your vehicle's maneuverability to escape combat. Bizarro day! The other thing that does not require your maneuverability rating, and that you can therefore do in this game with the missing transient maneuvering factor stat, is playing chicken. Because obviously the ability to change course quickly would be irrelevant in chicken. Chicken is an unusual aerial tactic. Allow me to quote from the book about how it's different from other combat maneuvers. Quote, "Everything we've talked about so far has dealt with the importance of the vehicle, the importance of skill, and the importance of luck in air-to-air combat. Chicken tactics bring in a new factor, guts." So if you're outclassed in the air, you might start a game of chicken to even the odds and make it a game of sheer balls. The rest of this section goes on to describe the chicken rules, which turn out to be literally the only place in aerial combat that you use your piloting skill and your air-to-air combat skill. Which means that in supersonic dogfighting, the only difference between a raw recruit and a seasoned veteran of aerial combat is how well they play chicken. Yes, that's right. If you're a fighter pilot, playing chicken is actually the only place where your years of training and experience matter, because it's Bizarro Day! So what do we do when we play chicken? Well, the first thing we do is we subdivide the melee round into 10 segments. 10 chances to veer away. You fly straight at your opponent, and over these 10 subdivisions, we have a growing penalty to veer away from the collision. In the first segment, we get a minus 10 penalty. In the second, a minus 20, and so on. These are percentile rolls. Unlike anything in the rest of aerial combat, you actually do roll your skill here. It doesn't specify that it's your pilot skill, but I can't imagine what else it would be. So because this is a combat-oriented percentile roll, you can add in your air-to-air combat skill as well. Remember that air-to-air combat, like offensive driving, is an add-on skill. It stacks on to your pilot skill, causes it to increase faster because both skills level up, and it allows you to have a skill level over 98%. Most skills top out at 98%, but with air-to-air combat or offensive driving, you can go over 100 so that you can take on gigantic penalties for bad road or high speed or whatever, and still have a decent shot of success. As we saw with driving, by sixth level, a strong driver has such a high total bonus that even in the worst conditions and the highest speeds, they almost always keep control of their vehicle. This game may have gotten the math on that pretty wrong, but the intent is that if you're good at driving, you can handle penalties that would wipe out lesser drivers. And so when I turn to fly directly toward my opponent at supersonic speed in this all-or-nothing game of courage, what overwhelming odds do I face? Well, it depends on whether I have the air-to-air combat skill, which if I'm a trained fighter pilot, I do not. Because it's Bizarro Day! That's right, it turns out that if you take the Military Combat Aircraft Skill Program, it does give you advanced pilot skills, but specifically it gives you the ability to pilot 4 different aircraft. It does not give you general access to advanced pilot skills such that you can take air-to-air combat. You can still get them, but it requires you to take the basic advanced pilot skill program as well. Yes, that does mean that once you've been through fighter pilot training, you need to go double up and take civilian pilot training to learn about aerial combat. Bizarro Day. So let's say that I do both. I've got a decent skill bonus. If I'm a fighter pilot, presumably I'm from one of those classes that is either like a military class or the PI, so I've got a nice big bonus, 10% or 15%. I'm going to end up with a 112% base pilot skill, or 122% for the PI, at level 1, which means that on the first thrilling round of chicken, my chance to veer away from sudden death is a mere 102%. If I'm a PI, I can go to round 2 and still have 102% chance to veer away. This somewhat deflates the heroism of my hotshot flying, and it reduces the tension of the first couple of rounds to 0 as things are not getting at all more dangerous. This problem worsens as pilots level up. By 6th level, an optimized pilot still has a 94% chance to escape the game of chicken unscathed on the 8th of 10 turns. Then on the 9th subsection, though, it does get a little dicey. He gets down to a mere 84% chance to pull away at the last moment from the clutches of death. And then on round 10, he dies. Now, I know what you're thinking. Doesn't he still have a 74% chance to pull away because he's got that gigantic over 100% skill bonus? No. As it turns out, a special rule provides that when the penalty to pull away from a game of chicken reaches 100%, notwithstanding your gigantic skill that is over 100%, you immediately drop to no chance to pull away and collide. Bizarro day! Now, you have to admire the complex failure of the chicken rules. The way that rather than acting as a skill equalizer, it turns chicken into the only thing that skilled pilots actually excel at over novices. The way that it manages to absolutely flatline the tension level of a tactic where rising tension is the whole point. The way that it turns a test of courage into a thing you literally have an over 100% chance of succeeding at. And the way that in the last round, it applies a special rule to subvert the point of the air-to-air combat skill, which can literally only be used in this situation. But for sheer perverseness of design, having exactly two ways to get away from combat, speed and maneuverability, and having your maneuverability bonus apply only to the speed one, has to be the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 142 of Ninjas and Super Spies. This is the last page of the air combat rules. And after a page yesterday that was pretty much all about playing chicken in midair, it is appropriate that we now get a page that is all about what happens when you deliberately fucking crash into another airplane, you fucking idiot. We find the answer on a little damage table. It's a little two-axis table that allows us to find impact damage according to the payload of the vehicle and the speed it was going. But any vehicle that's going to be playing chicken in the air is definitely on the heavier and faster side. So in essence, there are two answers to the question of what happens when you play chicken in midair and get it wrong and collide. The first answer is that you die. You take something like 700 d6 of damage, and I'm not even kidding. And even if you are the burliest sumo wrestler in the world, this is far beyond your structural damage capacity, and you are instantly obliterated. Proving once again that sumo wrestlers should not get drunk and joyride in fighter jets. You play chicken at Mach 1, you die. This is truth. This is justice. But this is not the end of the story, because there is a second part to the answer, which is that maybe you don't die. The dumbest thing on this page is the dumb luck rule, or as I like to think of it, the dumb luck rule. The dumb luck rule states that in any collision, no matter how fast, no matter how horrendous, no matter how certainly lethal, you get to roll a percentile as a last-ditch effort, and if you roll under a 20, then you are, quote, thrown clear and take only 4d6 damage. Now, it's not clear to me what being, quote, thrown clear means if you, for example, manage to run a space shuttle into the side of a mountain. The idea that you could survive a plane crash by jumping out a window at the last minute strikes me as kind of like that urban legend where if your elevator is falling, then you can like hop right up before it hits the ground floor and you'll be just fine. But what I really hold against the dumb luck rule is that I am personally offended by the idea of playing chicken at supersonic speed in expensive equipment. And the dumb luck rule provides the opportunity for that to go well. It, as with so many dumb things in this book, it provides the opportunity for a truly dumb moment. Imagine the scene. You are a dumbass player character. Some misguided soul has given you a fighter jet. You are swooping in low over the plane. An equally feisty NPC fighter pilot has spotted you and pursues you and is shooting at you. This is the GM's way of telling you you don't belong in that fighter plane, you don't know how to fly it. You decide to up the ante, and since you don't really know how to fly a fighter plane or use the aerial combat rules, you decide to just bang a quick UE, that's how fighter planes work, right? And fly directly at your foe. The GM, not to be outdone, decides that your foe flies directly at you. So here you are, low to the ground, tousling the grass, threatening to get caught in power lines, hurling directly toward one another at, let's say, 990 miles per hour. The damage inflicted by a crash at this speed is in the tens of thousands. You have 10 opportunities to veer away. You decide not to. You collide. There is a gigantic fireball. The GM reaches for his tackle box full of dice and begins to sort out 700 likely-looking D6s. But you remind him of the dumb luck rule. You roll your percentile. Your foe rolls his percentile. You both roll under 20. And so, while a hellish fireball lights the night sky, and two fighter planes go up in a conflagration that can be seen for miles around, you and your dumbass foe lightly tumble to the ground like kittens falling off the couch. You roll up against one another and you just laugh your asses off. You have each taken about 14 points of damage. I hate you both. And the dumbest thing on this page is the dumb luck rule that made it possible. Today we're discussing page 143 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We're just leaving the densest concentration of rules in this game. And that has led to some dense little podcasts, for which I apologize. This is meant to be short form. It's meant to be about goofy shit. We've been getting pretty deep into math and, you know, gender politics. It's been a winding road, is what I'm trying to say. And here we are back, though, to the bread and butter of Ninjas and Super Spies, with a page full of goofy shit that is going to sell your rule book to 12-year-old boys. Just a glance at this page tells you what it is. It is a giant list of ancient weapons with tiny little drawings of each one, all the way from axes to big honking swords. This page will be familiar to anyone who has ever read a core Palladium rulebook, because it is reprinted everywhere and visibly reprinted. Like, this is a bad copy. This may be the highest generation Xerox still extant. But despite the fact that it looks like it's been reproduced by being traced over carbon paper, I do love this page. I always have loved this page. As a little kid, this is what you want from a core rulebook, right? You want a big illustrated list of weapons to choose from. And this page does not disappoint. So let's dive into it and look what we've got here. We start with some axes, your typical axes that you expect. The battle axe, the throwing axe, all the usual suspects except for the onsen pick. I have no idea how to pronounce this. And I know that I have no chance of getting it right because of its language of origin. As it turns out, the onsen pick, or whatever, is an 11th century Welsh weapon. Obviously included here in case you want to have an unfrozen savage Welshman in your Ninjas and Super Spies campaign, which, why wouldn't you? The onsen pick is the biggest of the axes, the only two-hander. But if you want a big long weapon, and you're not an unfrozen savage Welshman, you're going to want the next section, which is pole arms. It is the longest of the sections. Whatever disease it is that old school gamers have that causes them to maniacally catalog almost indistinguishable pole arms, obviously Kevin Symbieta and the Palladium gang caught it from Gary Gygax at a convention at some point because it is rampant on this page. There are 14 pole arms here. This page has all your old favorites. The glaive, the halberd, the guisarme, the pike. It's got only a couple that I didn't recognize. One is the runka. Disappointingly, the runka turns out just to be another name for what we gamers know more commonly as the ransoor. Once again, pardon my pronunciation, I am neither an unfrozen Welshman nor an unfrozen Frenchman. The runka's in a big pack of these pole arms that are almost mechanically identical. The alpike, the beaked axe, the berdiche, the glaive, the guisarme, the lucerne hammer, and the runka all do 2d6 damage. And in fact, the beaked axe and the glaive are identical, except that the glaive weighs 1 pound more. So while they both cost $540, you get more pounds of pole arm per dollar with the glaive. So if you're into value for money, you would think that the glaive is the best choice. But in fact, the runka is also identical to those two weapons, except that it costs $95 less than the glaive. Now, in many role-playing games, the fact that one of these three identical weapons is cheaper than the others would make this an open and shut case for character creation, right? You want that runka. But that's because most role-playing games aren't dumb enough to support really dumb decisions. Ninjas and Super Spies does not have that failing. I know that when you buy a pole arm, you, like me, want to make a dumb decision and pick it based on how cool the blade looks. And Palladium's got you covered. If you like a big elaborate blade, kind of funny looking, looks like you could put googly eyes on it and it would actually kind of look like a chicken's head with a deadly beak, you want the beaked axe. If your style is simple and lethal, like I wanted to knife a dude but I didn't want to go all the way over there, therefore a pole arm, you want the glaive. And if you want an elegant forked design, looks a little more military, a little fancier, looks like perhaps you would guard someone important while wearing pantaloons with this blade, then you want the runka. The next section, spears, is much shorter. Only 4 of them compared to the 14 pole arms, and one of the spears is just the beaked axe again, sporting the same rooster-shaped blade, but brazenly masquerading as a spear. It is the chicken boo of medieval arms. But at least the spears get some diversity. Under knives, there is one entry, daggers and knives. It's got next to it a picture of like 5 assorted blades, which are characterized as 10 to 20 inches in length, weighing about a pound, you know, all knives, like anything from a switchblade to what is basically a short sword at a 20-inch dagger, weighs about a pound. They all do 1d6 damage, and they all cost $30 to $100. So you're telling me that in a game where there are 14 distinct variations of blade on a stick, a throwing knife and a mangosh have to share one? That's dagger phobia. There's no other word for it. This is bigotry and it will not stand. But we must move on to short swords, where I have to make my first on-the-podcast correction of the series. In this selection of short swords, which mainly include swords with big, thick, swoopy blades like falchions and cutlasses, there is a saber. Now, I believe that back in the Wushu episode of the podcast, I questioned the existence of a saber. Now, there is no weapon proficiency saber specifically, but here's the saber ready for play. In black and white, buried out of all alphabetical order on a list of other curvy short swords. I don't know how I missed it. Incidentally, for those of you looking for something to trigger your OCD, I recommend that you check out the exquisite wrongness of the short sword listing on this page, which is in almost exactly reverse alphabetical order, except that saber comes before scimitar. But screw all that. You're waiting for the main event of this page, the large swords section. Here, we've got your bastard sword, we got your broadsword, we got your claymore, and down almost at the very bottom of the page, we have the dumbest and the greatest thing on this page. Behold, the Dark Lord of Swords, the Flamberge. The Flamberge has a gigantic hilt, a massive blade. It does more damage than any other weapon of comparable size on the page. 3d6. Only a few of the pole arms rival it. And why? Why is the Flamberge so cool? It's because, one, its name means fire blade, and two, it is too fucking sweet. The Flamberge has a wavy, flame-like appearance to its blade. It looks nothing like the other swords on this table. Not only is the blade gigantic, but it's got this ripple effect, intended, it is said, to produce grievous blood-spraying wounds. This is the sword of black leather-clad badasses. It is my theory that they had to make the blade wavy to fit in all the edge. When you're a 12-year-old and you're shopping for things to chop people up with in a role-playing game, your eye goes immediately to the Flamberge. No other sword is as big, no other sword looks as cool, no other Western sword does as much damage as the mighty katana. If you want to be a knight who's as cool as a samurai, it's an uphill battle, but the Flamberge would not be a bad place to start. It is a magnificent, over-the-top weapon, and it is the dumbest thing on this page. I do feel obliged to point out, of course, that the Flamberge is a real weapon. Kind of. There's no indicator that it's as cool in real life as it is here in terms of its statistics, and Flamberge is not the correct term for the sword presented here, the big wavy-bladed two-handed sword. The weapon portrayed here should be called something more like a Flammenschwert. Join me next time as the parade of medieval destruction continues on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 144 of Ninjas and Super Spies. Last time we talked about some great medieval weapons, a big list of cool blades you could look at and fawn over when you're going to kit out your martial arts character or unfrozen savage Welshman. But today we've got to talk about the dark side of shopping for medieval weapons. There are some unscrupulous merchants of war out there, I regret to inform you, and not every purchase you can make from these couple of pages is a wise one. I'm here to warn you about some bad deals, give you some advice on who you can trust and who you can't. There's a very clear line, a literal line, on this page between the photocopied, illustrated list of weapons that you're going to find in lots of Palladium games and the beginning of the ancient Oriental weapons, which are specific to ninjas and super spies. Now, as much as I love His Unholy Majesty, Witch King of the Battlefield, the Flamberge, I am beginning to be dubious about buying weapons from this big list. And I'll tell you why. First of all, we get some blunt weapons on this page. A fair selection. 10 different weapons. Variations on the theme of hitting your foe with a heavy and blunt thing. And this isn't even including ball and chain, which is a separate category. Immediately, we see all the red flags of an unscrupulous medieval weapon salesman. Not only does he have a mace for sale, but he also has an Arab mace for sale. Looks pretty similar. Oh no, I assure you it is from the exotic Orient. Okay, that's appropriation. I think what happened here is that you had a mace and then you had another mace that's like half a foot shorter, and you decided to sell that one for the same price by supplementing it with backstory and piggybacking on someone else's culture. All right, okay. You're a salesman. That's no doubt why you have a Hercules club for sale, the longest and heaviest of the blunt weapons listed here. Looks pretty impressive on the little sketch. You're selling it for $260, despite the fact that it is, as far as I can tell, a very long wooden pole attached to a slightly thicker wooden head with nails driven into it. I'm pretty sure that any Home Depot or middle-aged dad with a workshop and a free weekend could make me a quote-unquote Hercules club for considerably less than $260. But okay, I congratulate you on your salesmanship, which is evident by the fact that you called this weapon a Hercules club and not by its other name, the Morgenstern. No one except me wants to charge into battle screaming, "You shall fall before my mighty Morgenstern." But the most egregious example of this slippery salesmanship, the thing you really need to watch out for in the blunt section, is the war club. You just look at the illustration for this thing. It is all asymmetrical. It didn't even require the accurate carpentry of the Hercules club. This is just a gnarled chunk of wood, but it's being billed as a war club. Now, if you want to buy a club, you can buy one for about $10. That's a low price, but not necessarily a huge steal, given that the same stats apply to sticks and pipes. So the value you're getting for your $10 is the same as you would get from, you know, pulling a branch off a tree. But this unscrupulous table is not content to sell you a piece of wood for $10. No. It wants you to upgrade from the $10 branch to the $75 war branch, which is exactly the same thing, but 3 inches longer. Both one-handed weapons, both weigh 3 pounds, both do a D6 of damage. But if you think that a piece of wood will kill your enemies deader because it is called a war club and not just a club, there is a $65 surcharge. Probably the war club comes with a certificate of authenticity, probably comes with a little stand so you can display it in your shitty apartment full of replica swords and ramen noodles. The war club is for suckers. Don't be a victim. In fact, I need you to get out of the whole blunt section of this table and just go shop for your blunt stuff below the line, because just listen to what the ancient oriental weapons section has to tell us about the bow staff. Quote, "Although staff weapons have appeared in virtually every culture worldwide, the techniques of use were probably most advanced in the martial arts schools of samurai Japan." This is where we can tell the author of this book is writing, because of his often repeated conviction that everything is better in Japan. "The size of the bow staff should be about a foot taller than the height of its owner. Cost, $120. Damage, 1d8. So that's what you get if you buy a bow staff below the line. Now come back above the line and see what this chucklefuck wants to sell you. He's selling a bow staff that also does a d8 of damage, but costs $140, $20 more, and is 9.5 feet long. Now, never let it be said that I don't love a big old medieval weapon. Obviously, given my love of the flamberge, which is both literally and figuratively the most metal of any weapon on this table, but I'm going to go ahead and submit that a 9.5 foot long bow staff is too fucking long. And you know what? It's just a staff. It's wood. It could be sawed down to length. That's what a person running a normal neighborhood medieval weapons shop would do. But this is how you know you're dealing with a real fucking carny. Whoever is running this table, he got his hands on a stupid 9.5 foot long bow staff, and instead of firing up his saw to make it usable, he decided to mark it up $20 and convince some poor sap that a staff this long is worth extra money. This is not a reputable establishment. The fact that this page has two entries for bow staff, which give disagreeing prices, is typical palladium buffoonery. But the fact that one specifically calls out the weapon should be about a foot taller than you, and the other one offers you a bow staff at a standard length of almost 10 feet long, that kind of refusal to update information after we've gone to the trouble of photocopying it is peak palladium. And that's the dumbest thing on this page. Join me next time as we go full weeaboo on a list of Asian weapons on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. New episodes drop every day, except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. MDC, Palladium Books, Ninjas and Super Spies, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Ciambietta. This slightly annoying theme song is Cartoon Battle by Kevin MacLeod, whose work you can find at incompetech.com. The gong sound effect was recorded by Daniel Simon. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.